Affiliates, here comes your revised year-in-review special. Both Panama and Romania have been put into the show. Their mention is made so as to give the stories their due place in the story lineup, but also so they are unlikely to be outdated by further events. The year-in-review begins in 5 seconds from Mark.
Zone. There are barricades in the street.
This old and historic city weathered this century's most severe hurricane.
At first when it started, I was in the back of the garage and it sounded literally like there was a football team running across the roof.
I will resign as Speaker of the House.
Today's verdict is a partial vindication.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush, you solemnly swear.
The sounds of 1989, a year of Berlin and Beijing, inquiries and earthquakes, a crash landing in Iowa and the battleship Iowa, a year of Rushdie and Bush. I'm Howard Dykus, and this is the year in review. The sound and the stories of 1989, next.
If the world were indeed a perfect place, clients would approve every proposal. Profits would consistently exceed even the most optimistic projections. The customer would always be right. The check would, in fact, be in the mail. And employees would never need to request time off to serve with the National Guard and Reserve. But then again, if the world were indeed a perfect place, we wouldn't need the National Guard and Reserve. For the time being, however, we do. They make up more than 40% of our nation's defense. Something to remember the next time an employee needs time off to serve. Something to remember until the world is indeed a perfect place. A place where copy machines never break down. Where elevators...
Be a hero. Give your employees the freedom to protect ours. A public service message from the National Committee for Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve and the Ad Council.
This was the sound of 1989, the sound of people who passed through a decades-old barrier to raise glasses in the West, the sound of the ultimate communist party.
Party!
It was an unbelievable sight, especially for veterans of covering the Cold War. UPI's Joseph Fleming reacts to the opening of the Berlin Wall.
I've been here since the war, and the wall kept them in, and a few would get out now and then and let some out, but I never thought this could happen. Never, never, never.
Not only did people walk through the wall, they chipped away at it with chisels. At famous Checkpoint Charlie, where East and West for years exchanged spies with guns drawn, hundreds of East Berliners drove to the West as pedestrians happily pounded on their cars. Eastern and Western guards put down their guns and stood side by side working as traffic cops.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
The opening of the Berlin Wall symbolized a flood of events in 89 that undid two generations of repression in Eastern Europe. Mikhail Gorbachev, who inherited a Soviet system close to collapse, shook that system and the world with his plan for restructuring. In Russian, perestroika.
Our perestroika is in earnest and for a long time to come. There is no turning back for anyone now.
Gorbachev fired the old guard. He put the Soviet parliament on live TV. He let his chief rival be seated in that parliament. And to the astonishment of the West, he let Soviet satellite countries in Eastern Europe go their own way.
My view is that President Gorbachev is different from previous Soviet leaders. I think he knows some of the things wrong with his society and is trying to fix them.
Gingerly, the people of the more easygoing communist nations began to test their leaders. The Solidarity Trade Union agitated for free elections in Poland. Polish-born Pope John Paul began putting double meanings into his calls for human rights.
International solidarity, and in particular, a worldwide solidarity.
Then it happened. Poland let Solidarity field candidates in a free election, and Solidarity won. A coalition with the communists led to the first non-party government of a communist nation ever. Next, communist Hungary opened its borders. Thousands of East Germans fled through Hungary to the West. They could be seen throwing their communist cash in the trash. The exodus brought down the East German government and opened the Berlin Wall. And freedom fever spread. Factory sirens wailed and bells rang when the same thing happened in Czechoslovakia. Perestroika, they yelled in Romania, and by year's end they were getting it, but at horrible cost. Before fleeing, Romania's leaders ordered troops to fire on demonstrators, thousands killed. And then there was China.
We want freedom!
We want freedom!
Students and workers occupied Tiananmen Square in downtown Beijing, a million of them demanding free expression. UPI's Mark Delvecchio.
The police stood there and allowed themselves to be pushed aside. The troops that were put in Tiananmen Square were unarmed troops.
Then everything changed. Hardliners won a power struggle at the top of the Chinese leadership. They made their victory evident one night. UPI's Dave Schweisberg.
This looks like a war zone. There are barricades in the street. We've just had armored personnel carriers in a wave come out onto the street.
Chinese tanks rolled right into crowds of demonstrators. Their repression filled Beijing's hospitals and morgues. Formerly friendly governments around the world were revulsed. Chinese diplomats defected by the dozens.
Before we are diplomats, we are Chinese, and we are human beings.
America was mostly an amazed bystander as the communist world changed. President Bush was diverted by other concerns. Like the danger to Americans posed by drug-dealing dictator Manuel Noriega of Panama, whose plots against Americans in his country led the president to order troops in to drive him out. But Mr. Bush did summit with Gorbachev to cut an arms deal off the coast of the Mediterranean island of Malta, motivated, the president said, by the desire of people for peace and freedom.
And that simpler truth brought Mikhail Gorbachev and me together and a windswept harbor off Malta.
On the windswept seas of Alaska, the U.S. in 1989 suffered its worst oil disaster.
The Exxon Valdez, a 987-foot tanker, ran aground on Bly Reef, about 25 miles south of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline terminal at Valdez.
Exxon spokesman Don Cornett making the first announcement of a spill so big that on the East Coast it would have stretched from Cape Cod to Virginia Beach.
I declared a state emergency because it is a state emergency. It's the biggest oil spill in American history, and I don't like the distinction.
The average Alaskan was as angry as Governor Stephen Cooper. Reporter Dave Hammack described an Exxon news briefing disrupted by citizens.
The Exxon officials are leaving by a rear exit. Folks out in the audience, as you've heard, crowd is, you can hear the crowd around me.
A senator said in a Japanese company the whole chain of command would resign. Exxon chairman L.G. Rawl responded.
I doubt if I have to comment on it, except that a lot of the Japanese kill themselves also, and I refuse to do that.
But he did fire the super tanker skipper Joe Hazelwood, who when he reported the grounding to the Coast Guard, blamed it on one of his mates.
Exxon Valdez, this is the captain of the port, Commander McCall. Good evening. Any more of an estimate as to your situation at this time, or?
Here's Hazelwood.
Not at the present, Steve. Joe Hazelwood here. A little problem here with the third mate, but we're working our way off the reef. The vessel has been holed.
The vessel has been holed, meaning a hole had been punctured. Many holes, it turned out. The third mate was not licensed for that area. Why was he at the helm? Hazelwood tested positive for alcohol. Months of cleanup could not save the lives of countless fish and birds, and Exxon finally quit, leaving vast stretches of shore black and slimy. By then, EPA Chief William Riley had summed up the matter with these words.
It is the San Francisco earthquake of ecological catastrophes.
We had one of those, too, in 1989.
The worst earthquake since 1906 hit the San Francisco Bay Area, knocking out power and telephone service to millions, including Candlestick Park.
UPI Radio's John Todges covering the third game of the World Series when the Richter 7 quake hit.
The fans here did not seem to panic when the quake hit. In fact, there were cheers from the crowd when the quake stopped.
San Franciscans learned quickly enough that there was little to cheer about.
There's fires in the marina. There's gas leaks.
There are people stuck in elevators all over the city.
People died when the roofs of their cars were smashed by the collapse of an elevated highway. UPI Radio's Bob Fuss.
It is the kind of nightmare scene that people who live in earthquake country fear the most. Here in Oakland, along the bay, for over a mile, the second level of this two-level roadway is collapsed onto the first.
Volunteers helped take the freeway apart in the search for survivors. There was only one, and he died later of his injuries. One volunteer, construction worker, Scott Connor.
This shouldn't have happened, and I would like to see how this finally comes out and who should go to jail over this.
Life was tough all over for the quake survivors.
Like most Californians, I've got a hot tub. We just filled that up last week. Haven't put any chemicals in it yet, so I guess that's our water supply for the next few days.
For the poor, the quake meant shivering in tent cities. It took weeks to bring a semblance of normalcy to the Bay Area.
I left my heart.
Which is why San Franciscans were so happy a month later when the busted Bay Bridge was reopened. Tony Bennett sang his old hit, Traffic Resumed. And then San Franciscans went back to repairing their lives.
It calls to me.
The quake was the second major natural disaster of 89.
This old and historic city weathered this century's most severe hurricane.
The mayor of Charleston, South Carolina. Joe Riley's town took a direct hit from the 100-plus-mile-an-hour Hurricane Hugo, a storm that already killed people in the Caribbean. UPI Radio's Rob Navius was in Puerto Rico.
Huge trees were uprooted, shards of glass from broken windows from resort hotels flying through the air like bullets.
When Hugo hit Charleston, UPI Radio's Jay Saper was there.
The rain is coming down in buckets. The winds are blowing everything in sight. I was driving a few seconds ago, and it was almost impossible to turn because I was turning into the wind.
Hugo wasn't just blustery. It was big. UPI's June Preston described how it felt far inland in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The wind is blowing pretty hard at this point, probably around 50 miles an hour. In fact, I'm having to hold on to the side of the telephone booth just to stay in one place here.
Hugo left thousands homeless and destroyed more commercial timber than the western wildfires of the year before. But there was a positive side.
Two babies were born down at Garrett High School last night in the shelter. Yeah. I guess they were due, and they just couldn't wait any longer. When the time to come, it comes.
Still ahead, a Top Gun dogfight over the Mediterranean and the ultimate negative book review as the year in review continues.
I'm Marilyn Quayle. I think most mothers feel the same way. When our children get sick, we wish we could do the suffering for them, but we can't. We can only give them lots of love and lots of care, and that includes making sure they take their prescription medicines properly. Improper use of medicine is a problem today for millions of children. They stop their medication too soon, skip doses, take it the wrong time, take too much or too little, or worse, they don't take it at all. These mistakes can be dangerous. That's why it's important to talk to your doctor, pharmacist, or nurse to know exactly how much medicine to give, when to give it, and for how long. Then talk to your children and all the people who take care of them. Every child, from crib to college, should be monitored in the use of medicines. It's up to us. Because when they're sick, we can't suffer for them. And when they're well, there's no greater joy.
A message from the National Council on Patient Information and Education.
Trouble came to a United Airlines flight over the Midwest in 1989.
We realized that we had more than just an engine failure.
Captain Al Haynes lost an engine, then lost almost all control of his jetliner.
It was apparent to us that we had lost all of our hydraulic fluid.
The nearest airport, Sioux City, Iowa.
We have no hydraulic fluid, which means we have no elevator control, almost none, and very little aileron control. I have serious doubts about making the airport.
And when I asked Dudley for the procedure for that, he said there isn't one. So we made it up as we went along.
The plane was continuing to roll to the right as it impacted.
When we hit, the plane broke in half right in front of me. I went on the back half of the plane. It rolled over twice, I think, and it burst into flames.
The airplane began to break up, and pieces were flying through the air. Huge fireball, a lot of black smoke.
I grabbed a little lady and a baby, and I went out the plane. And then I looked back, and there were just flames. And I ran into the cornfield.
More than 100 people died, but scores more survived. This air traffic controller had to be told that later.
Right after it happened, I had to turn away because, I mean, I really didn't think anybody would come out of it. And then I went downstairs and I cried.
Where one sat on the plane meant the difference between living or dying.
It's kind of hard to think that it was such a close call for us, and we feel really awful for the people who didn't have the luck that we did.
The United crash landing in Iowa was the airline's second disaster of the year. The first had come in February when the fuselage of one of its 747s burst open over the Pacific. Passenger Gary Garber.
I was sitting in the aisle. The people sitting next to the windows, I mean, they were gone. I mean, they were blown out of the plane.
The jet managed to land in Hawaii, but 9 people lost their lives. The U.S. Navy had its most accident-prone year in memory, with crashes, collisions, and fires. Worst was the explosion on the battleship Iowa.
I remember Turret 2.
Iowa Commander Fred Muselli at services for the 47 who died when Turret 2 of his vessel exploded during a practice firing.
They were the light, the spirit, and the soul of our ship.
When the Pentagon held a news briefing about the incident, a sailor who worked with the ones who were killed was put before reporters. His name, Kendall Truitt.
I lost a lot of friends. I knew Colonel Sermoji and myself were the only two gunners when they saw the 25 that are left in that division.
Then the story of the tragedy took a suspicious turn. It was learned that Truitt was the insurance beneficiary of one of the dead, a sailor who loaded the explosive charge. The Navy announced the explosion on the Iowa was no accident, and sources said the Navy suspected Kendall Truitt of being behind it. Truitt denied it and got a lawyer. At year's end, the Navy position was that the Iowa explosion was a suicide. But as Skipper Muselli points out,
there's a lot of theories. You know, unfortunately, all the witnesses died.
The literature story of the century happened in 1989. A head of state ordered a man killed for a book he wrote. The first report came from UPI's Lee Stokes.
Ayatollah Khomeini has sanctioned the killing of an Indian-born author of a book Muslims say they found offensive. Khomeini said anyone killed in trying to execute Salman Rushdie, author of Satanic Verses, would go to heaven as a martyr.
Rushdie was Indian-born but had become a British subject. So when Iranians took to the streets to protest his novel, they went to the British embassy, where Nick Brown was chargé d'affaires.
There has been a demonstration going on outside the British embassy. It is a very noisy demonstration, and a certain amount of rubbish has been thrown at the embassy.
The protests were so big, some people were crushed to death. Iran blamed that on Salman Rushdie. He actually issued a statement of regret, but Iran said it was too late to stop the death order.
It is like an arrow slung toward its target, and it is now traveling.
The British bristled. Foreign Secretary Geoffrey Howe.
We share a sense of outrage at the incitement to murder on British soil.
Bookstores in Europe and the U.S. were bombed. Some U.S. bookstore chains pulled the Satanic Verses from their shelves. Then another kind of demonstration began.
Freedom to read, freedom to write, put that book back in sight.
Members of the Writers Union held a protest in New York. UPI Radio's Ed Cairns was there.
Several hundred members of this union gathered here. One I spoke with said that writers not only have the right to be offensive, they often have the duty to be offensive.
Bookstore chains soon put Rushdie's book back, saying their own clerks wanted them to. And then the Khomeini death order backfired.
We started out with several that, quite frankly, they didn't sell that much until all the commotion started.
The Satanic Verses became a bestseller. Ayatollah Khomeini did not live to see his order carried out. He died 4 months later. But equally fervent Shiites succeeded him. The death order was never rescinded. At year's end, Salman Rushdie was still in hiding.
Two Libyan MiG-23 Flogger aircraft were shot down by two U.S. Navy Tomcat aircraft operating over international waters in the Mediterranean Sea.
The first announcement of a dogfight over the Mediterranean, only minutes away from where the shipboard summit would be held later in the year. And this is what it sounded like in the cockpits of America's F-14s.
207, 61 miles now, bearing 180, Eagles 8, heading 330.
The F-14 pilots maneuvered to avoid the closing aircraft.
10 miles, he's back on my nose, back one again.
Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci.
The U.S. section leader decided his aircraft was in jeopardy, and they could wait no longer.
6 miles.
2.
They flew flight patterns consistent with aggressive, hostile intent.
U.S. Ambassador Herbert Olken before the U.N. Security Council.
And when our pilots attempted to evade them, the Libyan pilots pursued repeatedly.
Good hit on one.
The result of the voting is as follows. 9 votes in favor, 4 votes against, 2 abstentions.
A resolution condemning the United States would have passed, but in the Security Council, the major powers have veto power.
The draft resolution has not been adopted.
Scandals from the Reagan years held the headlines in 89. Sam Pierce, the housing secretary so low profile Mr. Reagan himself once failed to recognize him, took the fifth on charges he channeled housing grants to developers. Oliver North was acquitted of many Iran-Contra charges, but convicted of 3 felonies.
Today's verdict by the jury here in Washington is a partial vindication.
North ended the year doing community service. His boss said North did good work, but wrote too many memos. 3 ex-congressmen went to jail in 89 for racketeering, perjury, and shoplifting. A sitting congressman was convicted of sex with a minor, and another was embarrassed by a gay lover who said he sold sex from his house. Former Senator John Tower was nominated for defense secretary, only to be accused of having a drinking problem. Tower swore off to try getting sworn in.
I hereby swear and undertake that if confirmed, during the course of my tenure as Secretary of Defense, I will not consume beverage alcohol of any type or form, including wine, beer, or spirits of any kind.
It didn't work. Tower became the first cabinet nominee rejected by the Senate in 30 years. And then there was Jim Wright. The House Ethics Committee found reason to believe he took illegal payments and gifts.
I will resign as Speaker of the House, effective upon the election of my successor.
Televangelist Jim Baker was charged with fleecing his flock.
I pleaded not guilty to all charges, which I am definitely not guilty.
Baker was convicted and jailed in a hospital prison, leaving America with the memory of the nervous collapse he suffered in the trial when he was found crouched and sobbing beneath his attorney's couch. Ted Bundy went to the chair in 1989, and people cheered. That was outside the prison in Stark, Florida. Inside, reporter Bill Wood.
A button was pressed, and Bundy's head snapped back as though he were in a car that had been rear-ended. And it remained there and never moved again.
Capital punishment stayed controversial in 89, but supporting it seemed easier the day Bundy was executed for assaulting and murdering young women one after another. As one death penalty supporter put it,
it's seeing justice done. And justice is really being done. And we're praising the Lord for this execution.
Still ahead, a playboy takes the plunge, and a goodbye to the giver, as the year in review continues.
Peace Corps volunteers, they're in every corner of the world, making a difference right now. They're opening hearts and opening minds, building bridges and bridging cultures, sharing skills and sharing themselves. Bringing new life to deserts and fighting disease. You can join them. But leave behind more than a new crop, a new forest, or a nourished child. You can leave behind people you've helped to help themselves, shaping their future as well as your own. No matter what your skill, engineering, education, agriculture, nutrition, you don't know how much you have to offer until you offer it. Peace Corps, the toughest job you'll ever love.
Call 1-800-424-8580, a public service message of the Advertising Council.
The war on drugs became a shooting war in 89, and not just when President Bush sent troops after Panama's drug-smuggling top general. Colombian drug cartels killed judges and journalists. Letter bombs in the southeast U.S., which killed a Birmingham judge and a Savannah councilman, looked like drug hits at first, but by year's end, the FBI suspected racist. Tracy Chapman had the album of the year in 89, then saw her new album banned in South Africa because one song was about Nelson Mandela. South Africa saw some change as ailing President Peter Botha quit, complaining that his cabinet had stopped listening to him. Successor Frederick de Klerk allowed more demonstrations and desegregated the beaches. At year's end, there was talk that the long-jailed apartheid opponent Mandela might be closer to being free.
Everybody sing, we're free, 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 free.
Ferdinand Marcos died in 89, but unrest in his homeland lived on. By year's end, Philippine President Corazon Aquino had survived six coup attempts. Baseball lost Commissioner Bart Giamatti only weeks after he banned Pete Rose from the game for gambling. The music died in 89 for fans of Roy Orbison. We also lost piano great Vladimir Horowitz and Irving Berlin.
Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune,
Laurence Olivier died,
or to take arms against a sea of troubles.
Actress Betty Davis died, and comic actor Jim Backus.
This one here, it seems to have a functional floor plan, and green is my favorite color.
Mr. Howell, that is a map of Australia.
Oh, do you happen to know how much you're asking for it?
The man of a thousand voices, Mel Blanc, died in 1989.
Bugs, they said, was a tough little stinker, and I had to get a voice for Bugs. And I thought, who could I make a small voice for who's a tough little stinker? But that may be Brooklyn or the Bronx.
So I put the two of them together. That's how I got the voice for Bunch, Doc.
The Lucy Ricardo Show!
Lucille Ball suffered a full cardiac arrest.
I don't think this is such a hot show, Fran. I think I'll get another station along.
As our first offering this evening, we stop that now. Go back and sit down.
She virtually invented the television sitcom and in the process set a standard that few successors could match. Lucille Ball was 77. It was a banner year for the box office. Americans flocked to theaters for Batman and a dozen sequels to past hits. A bold new director came into prominence. Spike Lee sparked fresh debate on issues of poverty and racism with his film Do the Right Thing.
Why don't you move back to Massachusetts?
I was born in Brooklyn.
No!
Some of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time did reunion tours in 89. Even the 40-something Rolling Stones.
More mature, more rocking, no solo material.
Playboy founder Hugh Hefner got married.
Do you take Kimberly to be your wife?
I do.
You heard him say that?
I did.
He said it. Everybody out there here, he said it. All right, I do. Okay.
So much has changed in 1989 that it's more apparent now than it was at the time how much the transition of power from Ronald Reagan to his vice president marked the end of an era.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Few people fully anticipated how much the atmosphere would change at the White House when the Bushes moved in. There was a new informality, epitomized by a sharp but self-effacing first lady.
Please notice the hair, the makeup, designer clothes. You may never see it again.
The Bushes made a catchy, engaging entrance. But then the Reagans had made an emotional, affecting exit.
I already said I should say something, but I'll never get through it.
President Reagan cued the band to cover his wife's tears after Nancy Reagan tried but failed to say goodbye to the White House staff.
I think the band was going to play something. Sing a brief clip.
And then the people who had been part of the most popular presidential administration in 30 years sang out the old era. Mr. Reagan sang off key. It didn't matter. This has been 1989, the year in review. Produced by Dennis Daly. Archival assistance from Rod Bauer. Executive producer David Oziel. I'm Howard Dykus. Have a great 1990. This is the UPI Radio Network.